ASI with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics. Hello and welcome to episode number 120 of Robots. My name is Jana and today we will discuss autonomous vehicles with CEO of Autonomous Solutions Inc., Mel Torrey. But first, let's take a look at robotics news and developments with Christine.
Thank you, Jana. The past year in robotics has seen advances across the board. A few developments, however, are particularly memorable. 2012 was remarkable for its wealth of robotics business news. Amazon acquired Kiva Systems, and iRobot acquired Evolution Robotics. Rodney Brooks' startup Rethink Robotics emerged from 4 years of stealth mode to reveal their manufacturing robot Baxter. And Helen Greiner's Sci-Fi Works also exited stealth mode to reveal their tethered drones for inspection and surveillance tasks. Dmitry Grishin launched his $25 million robotics investment fund, investing in Double Robotics and the Robot App Store. And crowdfunding platforms contributed to a slew of new robotics products. Willow Garage turned 5 and announced the creation of the Open Source Robotics Foundation, dedicated to supporting the development, distribution, and adoption of open source software for use in robotics research, education, and product development. Boston Dynamics released a series of new videos of their Cheetah, Atlas, Rex, and Sandflea robots. And NASA's Curiosity rover has successfully made it to Mars and is currently roaming the Red Planet. Autonomous cars also took huge strides towards becoming a reality, with more than 480,000 kilometers or 300,000 miles clocked by Google's cars alone, and legislation in California, Florida, and Nevada to allow autonomous cars to enter normal traffic. And finally, we launched RoboHub to bring together robotics volunteers and to report on news, views, and everything robotic. For photos, videos, and links to our favorite stories and robots in 2012, visit robohub.org.
Autonomous Solutions Inc., or ASI for short, is an American company which produces automated vehicle solutions for various industries, governments, and other organizations. Founded in 2000, the company's primary focus is on unmanned ground-based vehicles for commercial uses. President and CEO Mel Torrey spoke to our reporter about the company's autonomous vehicles and about surviving in the tough business landscape of today.
So, welcome to the podcast. Today we're going to talk about autonomous vehicles. It's going to be all about autonomous vehicles, but it's also going to be about the story from research to a corporation, which is not always an easy transition. So can you start with how you got into robotics to start with?
I was working on some space shuttle programs and was walking down the hall in the engineering building and saw a wheelchair driving by itself. And I was in an undergrad program with research and tracked down this wheelchair, found out who was running it and who his boss was, and then I started to bug him for a job. And about 3 months later, got stuck in the same elevator with his boss, and he finally gave me a job for soldering and worked my way up in that lab. They paid for my graduate work and started managing programs for Department of Energy, Department of Defense. And John Deere saw some of our publications and said, hey, we'd like to start working with you at the university. That went well, and they asked us to start a company. And so we spun out about 12 years ago and have been doing robotics across the ground vehicle space ever since.
So an autonomously or a remotely or autonomously driven wheelchair or?
It was autonomous.
It was
and
autonomous.
So the idea was someone with limited spatial mobility skills could go down the middle of a hallway and it would just keep you in the middle. And so it had ultrasonic sensors bouncing off the walls and kept it. And that project did die because they were afraid of someone flying off the stairs. And so liability kind of shut that down. But fascinated me. It seemed to combine the electrical, mechanical, and software interests that I had a little more down to earth than some of the space shuttle work where it seemed to be helping people. And so I was excited about the potential.
Mm-hmm. And then you went into the research and you did that. Could you tell us a bit about what your different research topics was within this autonomous vehicle space?
It started out kind of boring with more just control systems, closing the loop on driving actuators, driving vehicles straight, but then evolved into the obstacle detection and safety. And that is what brought John Deere in. They wanted, if I have a three-year-old running out in front of a tractor, can we stop these things safely? That's a key determination before we really get serious about this market. And so we actually had remote control styrofoam cars that were the size of three-year-olds driving at tractors and trying to get run over. And that was kind of the research there, is just with the current sensors and the pricing points, can we keep something safe?
And I guess since this is now out in the field, we're going to talk about that later. You were successful. Even if it was a human trying to get run over by the tractor, they wouldn't be, huh?
Correct.
That is amazing. That even if you try to, you couldn't be. That's because a human can be pretty tricky if he wants to.
And I think that was 14 years ago. The sensors were definitely more limited than they are now, and a child crawling through the bushes, those kind of scenarios, I think you can find a way to get run over. But the scenarios they wanted were, I'm out doing standard tillage, standard farming operations in an open field. Can I get run over?
When you
get into orchard vineyards and jumping out of a tree, you're going to get smacked. But
So tilling and just treating these big open spaces, that seems to be a more manageable problem. But you're also working in orchards, and you're working in vineyards and other venues like that. That must be much more challenging.
Yeah, it's definitely difficult, but it is where the bleeding is happening as far as the need for labor. It's very difficult to find workers in the U.S. that can handle the workload, the difficulties in the hot weather. And it's also difficult because right now, tractors are pushing away the branches as they drive through. And so how do you get a sensor that can detect what's really passable and what isn't? You don't have a radar that you can dial in the density of wood that I care to avoid. So there's some challenges there, but we have some solutions that we use, and it's going well. We're excited.
So we talked about basically lower crops. Is it also corn and higher crops you're trying to address, or?
Yeah, we've done crop spraying, for example, with sprayers that are tall enough, wheels are high enough that they can straddle the corn. Really farming in general.
And I guess you built a common platform, because most of the technology is the same between them, and then you adapt them to the different vehicles.
Yeah, the key to us being able to do as many applications as possible is really having those common building blocks, and then so whatever specific to that application, trying to keep that as small as possible so that we can leverage the work and minimize the effort, because profitability is always a challenge if you're customizing every application you do.
Because you have adapted this technology to a fantastic array of vehicles. We're talking tractors, we're talking construction equipment, we're talking special equipment for police and rescue workers, military. There's a very broad range, but that is just amazing. But it's possible then to do that at a reasonable cost, because you use the basically the same technology.
Yeah, it's really been a saver for us, because, like I say, some economies can crash in certain markets, and if we didn't have that diversity, we would have been in big trouble, especially in the end of 2008 when the recession took out our mining and our ag business. Mm-hmm. So having those common building blocks enables that and it's been important for our survivability. So
yeah, is there? So you started with the agribusiness, and did you then go to construction or mining? Agribusiness and mining was the two first ones, or?
No, we started in ag, and we immediately started writing government grants for robotics development, and that started to flow. The ag, we started the business in the ag, doing orchard tractors. That got killed after the first year. There were liability concerns, lawsuits, those kind of things, with working with a big corporate partner. And luckily, we had volunteered to do a free lawnmower for golf courses in our spare time in the evenings. And so 80-hour weeks, we had done these golf course mowers, demonstrated that, and the ag dropped out and went to zero completely, but we were able to start doing golf course mowing, and that really was our first near-death experience, and it kind of took off from there. A lot more diversity, then we started to do autonomous backhoes along with the golf course mowing, and then ag picked up again later. So,
And then where did mining come in?
Mining came in about 2004 and 5. That's when, again, they were facing some of the same labor challenges we're seeing in Orchard Vineyard right now. Extreme high costs, especially in the outback, northern Canada, Alaska. And so we were approached by the largest copper mining company in the world that's privately held, and asked us to start automating trucks and bulldozers. And so we applied those same building blocks. Both the building blocks consist of the hardware, electronic components, typically automotive, coupled with the software embedded in those processors. And we applied that to the mining and started doing autonomous trucks and dozers and through 05, 06, 07, and 08.
And then that was for mining or for construction?
Mining.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, we had done construction starting in probably 03, 04.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is very impressive. This all came out of research, and I think you have some interesting information to share there around how you got the research out, how to bring the research with you when you exit academia and want to start a business. I know you have some challenges there. Can you tell us a bit more about what your experience are?
Well, it's definitely difficult in academics because of the different priorities. They need to publish, they need to tell the world what they're doing. There's a desire to be like Stanford and Carnegie Mellon and really have a large portfolio of products that are out in the field feeding a lot of money back to the university, and so that makes it challenging. I had an incredible professor at the university who was very supportive and helped that transition. There were certain things we had to start from scratch and rewrite. But we continue to face that as we fund students in the university, as we fund university programs. We have good relationships with Utah State University, University of Florida, and you have to work hard to find someone that's flexible, willing to adapt their financial models so that you can take out the technology and still have something feasible in the market that'll be affordable and successful. So it's a challenge, but we continue to learn, and it's working so far.
Mm. Have you worked only with U.S. Universities? Do you see a difference in other regions of the world?
I definitely see some impressive things in Europe and Australia, but
with respect to this getting the research out, I meant.
I haven't gotten that far into it to explore how hard or easy it is to get that out. There's definitely impressive technology, but I think we've been so consumed with even just the U.S. opportunities that we haven't had that opportunity to look further.
Mm-hmm. You also participated in the Grand Challenges, the two desert ones and then the urban one, I guess?
Yes, we funded University of Florida for the first two, so we provided software and money and expertise and worked in the trenches with them on the first two. And then because the urban one was so close to the mining work that we were engaged in, we decided to go that one alone and really put our building blocks from the urban challenge vehicle onto mining trucks as we were going. So every week as we did a build on the urban challenge, we would download that code onto the mining trucks down in the mines in Arizona and run those same algorithms, because a lot of the same problems were being solved.
Which is just my next question, was that the urban challenges, the DARPA program, have been tremendously successful, and you just answered that by saying you actually download them once every week.
Yeah.
Because it has been very significant, right?
Yeah, I believe so. I'm not sure about everyone's experience with it. We got $1 million through that program, and I didn't prioritize winning the race. I prioritized we will have building blocks from these capabilities and used in mining, and that is non-negotiable. Winning is secondary, and we got the mining trucks, and we're shipping mining trucks. So it was definitely a great opportunity to solve the problems that we needed in the real world, and we're using it. So,
When we're talking the mining, is it so that this is field robotics in the sense that the mine is totally close to humans, or are they interacting with vehicles driven by humans, or humans in the environment without the vehicle?
It's going to be a while before all the vehicles will be full autonomous. So you have human operators doing the loading, for example, is one of the tougher challenges. So we have human vehicles, they're all marked with GPS, and then we have certain logic and traffic management to keep the vehicles at safe distances, automatically regulate following distances. You can do lockout, tagouts to keep certain areas safe when you're servicing a vehicle. And then levels of authority in logging in so that a serviceman could take over a platform and it won't autonomously power up and run over him. So there's the reality is you have to deal with humans in that environment. And so we've had to develop the different components, both on human-driven vehicles and the unmanned ones, to keep everything synchronized and safe.
Yeah. And the track record so far, have you had any issues?
Issues? Not as far as safety. There's obviously technical hurdles that you work through. We found that the technical challenge is maybe 20-30% of the problem you've got, especially in mines. If you have unions, just this is how we've always done it kind of challenges in education and changing the approach to the problem. And there's the liability hurdles as you bring in partners and yourself. The liability, as we look at the threats or the what could really hurt our company, an accident is the highest. And so you've got to deal with that threat. So there's the technical challenge is really a minority in percentage compared to all the other problems that you have to solve to really get a full autonomous system up and running and successful.
So you also are working on we're getting even further out where there's more people and more other things to take in consideration when you do automated convoys. Can you tell us a bit about that? What's the context you want to use that in?
Yeah, we've kind of got a unique approach there because of this challenge of getting it right now. How do you create a system that driving through streets in Iraq does not veer off and take out someone on the sidewalk, and they can be deployed right now? And so we've done GPS following, we've done GPS denied navigation, but you've got inertial solutions, you've got lasers and radars and GPS that all can either be jammed, that can be blocked by the trees. Tons of challenges there. So we actually went with a dog leash approach. And so you have to see video to believe it. But basically, there's a dog leash on the front of all these trucks. You pull the dog leash out, the vehicle starts up and starts following the exact path that you take. And a lot of people thought it was stupid. It was almost canceled by the Pentagon until the representative got in the truck and it drove just like a human and followed in the exact path of the vehicles in front of it. And now it's shipping to Afghanistan. We have units in Singapore. So it's something that can be fielded, safety certifiable right now, because it's basically just automotive sensors versus doing a mean time between failure on GPS blockage coupled with multiple sensors. It's impossible to prove that it's safe right now. So that's a system that can immediately reduce labor by 2 or 3, depending on how many trucks you put in a row. It's getting fielded, so we're pretty excited about that.
Yeah. How many trucks are you looking at? Is it 2 or 3 right now? And how do you see it for the future? When we will see 100 of them in a row?
Yes, we need to do 100. I think right now, 3 as you get the narrow roads, the cost of the sensor to get the angular resolutions to keep you within a narrow road winding through a jungle, three is about the limit at the cost point that we have. If you want more, then you need to add a more expensive sensors onto the solution. But it's just a string. You can repair it with your shoelace, and it's got a couple of neat applications, both in convoy and robotics deployment. Another example, we envision cutting the cabs off all the tractors. So how do you transport a tractor from field A to field B across a public road? With this leash system, you just grab the string, hook it onto your pickup truck or your four-wheeler, and pull three pieces of large farm equipment down a public road that don't have cabs on them. So
yeah, and portion them out as they come to the field where they're supposed to work. Yeah.
Yep. And another neat thing about that solution is it's speed-based following. So as you go 60, 70, 80 miles an hour, they all pull apart for safe stopping distance. When you go into town, they all come in nice and tight for sharp turns. Mm-hmm. Anyways.
So this is something also that could be used for highway traffic in I mean, not only in a war zone, but even in like here, we're in Pittsburgh right now. Could that be used here?
Yeah, I think where we're hearing the interest right now is in Australia, where they can't build a railway, so they have a bunch of semis that are hauling material from the mine to the port, or up in Alaska, where they're in the ice fields, they're transporting multiple semi loads in a certain from point A to point B, fairly simple long runs. That's a pretty nice and probably one of the early adopting applications.
Mm-hmm. But I also know that trucking is a huge industry in America. They use that for hauling basically everything.
Yeah.
So are we going to see these on regular public roads?
Well, I called UPS. That didn't go really well. They want the truck manufacturers to prove that out before they get to it. Mm-hmm. And for us, we've got to find the people who are bleeding. Where is the pain? And that really is in the outback and in Africa. I'm sorry, in Australia or northern Canada, where labor is so expensive. Mm-hmm. And yet it's a straight road. There's no traffic and you're just driving a long way. So that's where we've got to target. Yeah. And that's what we're doing in mining.
And there you'll also work out any small detail there might be left, and you'll also prove it. I mean, if it's been running up there for a number of years, it's going to be easier to come to these other companies and say that, well, it works there.
Yep.
If it works in the freezing outback of Alaska or the scorching outback of Australia, it's probably going to work here.
Yes. Yeah, so that's sure the approach.
Yeah, we've talked about the really big things, the mining trucks and the bulldozers, but you also work with smaller platforms.
Yeah, we automotive, for example, we do just proving ground automation for automotive industry. So we're getting thousands of miles on autonomous vehicles working at automotive equipment manufacturers in Detroit, for example. Some of the largest in the world are using our kits to automate. Hey, we have a brand new, this model of vehicle, 2013, put our kit on, beat it up, put it through the rumble strips and beat the heck out of that vehicle, try to accelerate the testing so that you can.
So there you use the autonomous driving not to get from point A to point B, but to use it as a part of the testing.
Yep. That's and so we have one operator watching seven vehicles. We want to get up to 1 to 30. So you have a human overseeing 30 different autonomous vehicles doing their operations and being able to beat them up without putting the human through that kind of abuse. Right now, they're limited to 30 minutes in a vehicle at a time. Then they have to get out and rest for 2 hours because of the abuse to the liver and back. And so it's a nice application. It's nice visibility with the major OEMs in the automotive industry, and it just puts thousands of hours on beating up our stuff.
Yeah, yeah, so not only durability. The car gets beaten up, but your stuff gets beaten up.
So it might be at max a $10 million business, but we've got great traction. We've got some of the biggest in the world using it and many more asking for demonstrations. So that's going well. That's an example of the midsize. And then down into the smaller equipment, we've done under vehicle inspection in Iraq for bomb disposal. And we have some small robots in the underground mining environment and bomb disposal. So doing some 3D vision, 3D mapping, GPS deny type navigation with the smaller robots. And, and the exciting thing about that small robot bomb disposal type stuff is we're leveraging it in the mining industry for the monster shovels that are 100-ton shovel, for example, leveraging the same vision and autonomy control from an arm that lifts 5 pounds. So some neat leverage there from research that started with the government.
So thank you very much for being part of the podcast. And we're going to link to some awesome videos and other stuff so that the listener can check out the amazing vehicles you've built.
Wonderful. It's been a pleasure.
And that's all for today. As always, you can find more information, videos, pictures, and discussion forums on our website at robotspodcast.com. The Robots team wishes you all a very happy new year, and we'll be back in January. Until then, goodbye. ASI with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics.